It's been over 320 some odd days since the last time we had college lacrosse in Division One. We had our first two games since March 11th, 2020, and they were fun. Welcome to this. We're gonna brand this as the R&R podcast. I am Chris. Alongside me is Steve Ficado and Jake Nazar. We'll be rotating, trying to do this podcast the rest of the year. R&R, usually it's rest and relaxation. It's more of rapid and reaction. Folks, how are we doing after the first two games of college lacrosse played in January?
The weather wasn't bad.
I didn't think, it was a little windy in Denver, it seemed, but sunny at least. It wasn't snowing, so that was a blessing. I mean, it was a little melancholic today, the news, which we'll get to, about Sean Goldsmith, but it's great to see the boys out there. Good to see, the goals and everyone getting out. Seemed everybody was excited to be back on the field. So I'm very happy for it. So I think everybody else on this spot is as well.
Looked a little low key, maybe weak negative one. But it wasn't bad. Does the weather not being bad help or hurt your propaganda? Because I felt like your whole thing was that snow lacrosse was good. So does the lack of inclement
snow lacrosse
support or hinder your stance?
Jake, I'm happy you asked. As you know, our movement is an open and transparent one, so that we always try to answer all questions. I think it both, it definitely helps because it shows, you get lampooned when it's snowing. I mean, I think visually kind of cool and we get a little bit of the meme, but it's easy to pick on early lacrosse when it's really snowing. So my real, the showcase for early January lacrosse is, the Jacksonville's and the North Carolina schools playing. It's a little bit warmer. It fits for the content. As soon as football is pretty much winding down, right into lacrosse. If the NFL did the right thing, added a couple more weeks, gave another bye week, had football go through President's Day, then yeah, lacrosse could reasonably start mid-February. But
I'm glad we could have a dialogue.
Of course, Jake. We're always open for all questions.
Well, two games down, two games without any bad weather. So I have that as a W. The first game of the day was Bellarmine 9, Mercer 7. We'll get to that later. But we'll start off with probably the highlight of the day. It was Denver 9, Utah 8 out in Denver, Colorado. And things looked shaky for the Pioneers in the first half. They were down 3-1. It was nearly 4-1 with a near chance with a second left at halftime. And then kind of when the second half happened, all things went in favor of the Pioneers. They had a 5-2 third quarter led by two goals from Ethan Walker in that quarter and also a pair of goals from Jack Hanna, who kind of took the wheel and kind of drove that car for Denver to begin the half. But Utah put up a fight, and they looked, as much as they were sloppy, and Denver was a little bit sloppy as well, they put up a fight. It was a one-goal game. Utah kind of made it interesting very late. I thought after that, the J.J. Silstrop goal, that was Denver's final goal, they made it 9-6. That was the game, and unfortunately, that was not the case for Utah. But just going off of that, Denver, they looked not that great, but do you think it's more of, is it rust or is it not rust? Is it because of the fact that, do we give them more time? This is probably not who they are. By the way, they missed 12 guys today. Three starters in Skylar Blair, Alex Simmons, and defenseman Colin Squires. So that might have put a role. But, 10 months after your last game, that does a lot. No fall ball. But maybe do we give a break just because it's their first game?
I mean, the games are going to don't want to say sucked, but it wasn't, the first half was not good. And so, I mean, I'd be hammering, I'd tweet this out, I'd be hammering the under for like every game till like March. Because teams are just not, you can't, you know, come in without really having fall ball, and without really even scrimmaging and expect teams to look at their best. I also tweeted out, I think it makes it more interesting for next week's games for Denver, if they happen, hopefully, fingers crossed, with Duke and Carolina, because that'll give us an idea of where Denver's at, you know, vis-a-vis other elite teams or other teams that people expect to be, you know, Denver to be in that kind of orbit. Ultimately, yeah, I think that, like, I think at attack, I think they'll be fine. Jackson Moore didn't have a good game, but I don't think that'll be a problem. Ethan Walker did have a good game. He looks good. JJ Silstrip was solid. He's a player. So at attack, they'll be fine. Like, I don't anticipate any problems there. The midfield, they were not good. Outside of Jack Canna, who's a beast. And that's where I think if there's a long-term problem from this, that's not just rust and it's their first game and it's naturally going to be sloppy and it's January 30th and it was windy and all of that. I mean, like, they were 1-for-8 on the extra man. They're not going to be 1-for-8 on the extra man at that kind of rate for the entire season. It's the midfield. And they missed Alex Simmons, and I think he'll be an important player for them. Like, Ted Sullivan's okay. He's a good player. He's not an amazing player. You know, he couldn't really win a matchup today. Utah was coached extremely well on defense. They looked really good. But, you know, Sullivan's a senior. You know, I think his career high in goals is, like, 17. You know, he's solid. But he's not, you know, a guy who you're going to expect to run by his man on a consistent basis. Or he hasn't been that guy. Lucas Kotler was a kind of highly touted addition because he came with Morrill. And I'm not saying he's a bad player, but like, he wasn't a starter for Yale until last year when he was a senior. Like, in 2019, he played on their second-line midfield. And he was a really good second-line middie. Don't get me wrong. I think he had 25, 30-something points. But still, he was not a, you know, top guy for them. And now he's coming over to Denver, and he's being put into that kind of role. And he didn't have a good game. So that's my question, ultimately, is that midfield, aside from Jack Hanna, who they're going to, like, Morrill and Walker will get the attention, but Denver's going to live and die by how good Jack Hanna is all year long, is whether can they get more from the midfield. And Simmons is a bit of a, you know, he was a sophomore last year. This is only his second full season. So he's got to look out for it. If he's got some jump in him and he's, you know, can be kind of closer to Hannah's level, I think they'll be fine. But I think that's the thing to look out for if their offense has longer term issues, or if as opposed to this was just, you know, one game blip or maybe, you know, 2 to 3, 4 game blip before they get into the sink of things to start the year.
Yeah, I think a little bit of both. Jake, yeah, definitely the long delay had something to play, deal with it, but the fact that, you know, this was not dissimilar to a lot of early season lacrosse we've seen in the past. So I think, you know, it was probably exacerbated by the fact that, you know, they haven't played since last March. But like I said, right around the second half, we all mentioned in the DMs of the game, the quality of the game, you know, increased significantly. And, you know, the ending was great. So I thought, you know, we got a pretty good product by the, yeah, in totality, especially in the second half. Regarding Denver, there was Utah really good. Was Denver really bad? I think it's a little bit of both. I think, you know, Utah has been a team that's, while young, has a lot of promise, and it's definitely been competitive, especially last year and the year before. Games, even though they would lose, they would do quite well and put up a big fight. This one, I think you looking at Denver, you know, going 0-for-4 and extra man opportunities in the first half isn't something ideal. But I think that they started to find their groove in the second half, and that spurt by Hanna really essentially, I don't want to say saves them, but, you know, it was not a pretty efficient offense at that time. And those two goals really, you know, kind of pushed them forward and get into tie, and then Ethan really started starting to get hot towards the second half after that early first quarter goal. So I think at the end, you know, Denver looked like a team that at least much better in the second half. But yeah, Utah still fought through the end, and if they got that last face off, who knows? They may have been able to push into overtime. So I think, you know, bodes well for the Utes. I think that does expose a little bit of questions for Denver, but I think a lot of people are just going to, you know, give them the first game, and especially the fact that it was a long since our last game.
As they should. And, you know, like, if I had to take anything positive away from kind of overall, I think it's just Utah and their, you could say it's their lack of experience. They only have two upperclassmen on that team, but their lack of experience and their youthness. They've showed past 2 years that they won't be tough to play. They will be tough to play against. Obviously, like, they have a few things to patch up. Obviously, you know, they had like what, 4 or 5 shot clock violations. They also were penalized 8 times in that game, and one of them was very late, and that did kind of cost them a chance to potentially force a turnover and tie the game. But you kind of clean those areas up as you go along, and that will be a very tough team to play. And if you clean those things up earlier too, maybe that's a game where you go to overtime and maybe you win, or you win in regulation. And I thought, obviously, it kind of hurt special teams. Utah hurt. It was hurt in another way too. They also went, I believe, it was 1 for 3 on the man up, and they scored one in the third quarter, but. The one where they didn't score, which was man down, which was 14 seconds left, you know, Jack Thompson made a save, outletted it out. They cleared the ball. Ethan Walker scored. And I thought, you know, that gave Denver the lead and they kept it the entire time. I knew in my head, like, that's going to be the game. That's the game. They were riding all this momentum. I didn't think I was going to see Utah kind of claw back into this and at least tie the game. They did claw back, but not enough to tie the game. Utah will be tough. They play Bellarmine next week. And again, I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt to Denver that this is just, you know, it's a first game jitters, let it all out. They looked a lot better in the second half than the first half. Matter of fact, I'd say maybe both teams did, and maybe in the other game too, you could say both teams looked great in the second half of that game. So, look, Hannah looked great in the second half. Everyone looked better in the second half. I'm very pleased with how Hannah played. Shellstrop looked explosive. The midfield, Jake, you kind of mentioned it too. They looked a little bit of a concern besides Hannah. The short stick defensive midfielders, I thought, for Denver, combined 5 cost turnovers, at least for Danny Logan and Kyle Smith. Danny Logan is a baller.
Monster.
He's been a monster that way since the freshman year, and I know he's kind of flown a little bit under the radar, but he's like he's in the top, I would say maybe the top 3 in terms of short stick defensive midfielders in the country. And on the other end, you know, if we want to keep talking about the defensive midfield, how about Sammy Cambert? And he had a couple of calls turnovers. He had a really nice play in the first half where he kind of intercepted a ball in midair. He also had a goal earlier in the first half, and look, I've seen him play when he was a freshman in 2019 when Utah played Vermont and Hartford. He was a very talented player right from the bat from when I was seeing him. I saw him last year, just watching their games, he looked very good. And Holman has said if he was on a top 15 team, you know, he would be getting All-American honors. But we have also noticed that he is playing really well. And Jake, you mentioned it really well. You put it on Twitter. You know, he was an honorable mention All-American last year.
Yes, he was. CollegeCross.com. Check it out.
That's the site you got to read. So he is, I get Coach's point that, you know, maybe it's also, and he also talked about, you know, this team would be getting this half of Division I kind of forgot about Utah because you're not in a conference. And I agree with that. I think being in a conference, and you see teams like Bryan and St. Joe's and High Point, even if they weren't if they were independents, they would be getting zero talk. But that's what I think Utah's going on. But I think if Utah gets into a conference very soon, you'll start to hear more about Utah and that program and who are some of these guys, such as Sammy Cambair. And I thought this kid, Tyler Bradbury, and attackman, had a very good game. Ramsey McCreary, a former Notre Dame transfer, Jordan High, looks like he'll also be good. You know, this will be a young team, and this will be it's a very good thing for their experience that they can build on.
Yeah, we'll see how these young. I mean, they're playing a bunch of young guys on attack. I just thought they're clearly coached extremely well, especially on the defensive end. I mean, they forced Denver into a bunch of bad shots. They just looked a lack of talent on the offensive side of the ball. Again, they're all young. It was their first game, so that's we'll see if they get better. But I mean, you saw that they lost, you know, like literally all of their offense from last year. So I think that's
top six scorers, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, Colin Burke, Jimmy Perkins, Matt Coaston transferred. He was a freshman. Josh Stout was a junior. He's not there anymore. And then Gelstead was also gone. I think Brandon Wilson, too. That's, yeah, their top six guys. That's, yeah, I mean, does being in a conference help your recruiting? Probably. That's probably got to be the goal for them. Because if they can get some talent, they coach guys up really well. And their systems in place are, you know, really good. Even, I mean, offense, the 6-on-6, they weren't great, but they scored a bunch in transition. They did have, you know, a goal on the extra man. They found ways to generate offense outside of, you know, the 6-on-6 where they struggled. So, yeah, that's the key, is there some talent among these younger guys? Is there potential there that they can, you know, kind of harness? Because I would have loved to seen this game with some of those guys Utah had on their team a year ago, or even some of the guys they had in 2019. You know, James Sexton, Josh Stout, those were two guys who, you know, really good. So Stout almost had 50 goals in their first year as a program. So, it's, you know, look, it's hard to be kind of the team way out, you know, by yourselves in compared to the rest of teams in Division One. So hopefully they can find, you know, a kind of recruiting sort of base for them to mine talent for, because I think they're clearly coached really well.
I do want to point this. Sorry, go ahead, Jake.
No, go ahead.
I do want to point this out on Utah's route. I have Utah's rosters pulled up, and here are some of these guys that, you know, had a very big impact in today's game, or at least for starters. Ramsey McCreary, where they went to high school, or at least where they're from. Ramsey McCreary, the Woodlands in Texas. Jordan Hyde, Bloomsfield Hills, Michigan. Jonathan Rose, Atlanta, Georgia. Brandon Wilson, San Clemente, California. Sammy Cambair, Flower Mound, Texas. MJ McMahon, Sarasota, Florida. Tyler Bradbury, Oak Park, California. There's a few, maybe I might have missed one. That's it, never mind. But, like, a lot of these guys are not from your typical, you know, hot spots for high school lacrosse. They're all around, you know, Texas, and they're budding, I would say, budding, like Texas and California and even Michigan and even Florida for a little bit. But, you know, you're able to attack those spots and get the talent that maybe other programs are not looking at too hard. That's going to be a very successful program.
Yeah, and it's you know, keeping them to it. It's hard to bring, you know, guys, especially, you know, with COVID and everything. We've seen, you know, some footballs, you know, teams that have had a lot of transfers, because it's hard to get guys from way out of state, you know, who aren't getting the usual college experience, you know, to stick around. And, you know, Texas is close to Utah. I think that's definitely an area that they can take advantage from, advantage of. But, you know, Florida and Michigan, hopefully, you know, if they do get those East Coast guys, they can, Michigan's Midwest, but, you know, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
They can get them to, you know, stick around and develop, you know, some pipelines. I think, yeah, Texas and California are two places, yeah.
Zach Johns from their goalie, that he had a really good game too. Henderson, Nevada. So you take those western states, like, again, Arizona, Nevada, even Colorado, even Utah, California. You can put something together, and you are now the westernmost school in Division I college lacrosse, and you're a Power Five school that Denver can't say, Air Force can't really say, So if you want to go to a Power 5 school and play lacrosse, that's your place.
I think Utah would bode well to follow the Denver model. Like right now, yeah, as you guys noted, mining your in-state talent. There's 21 players on Denver's team from the state of Colorado. So Tierney definitely has the Boulder State on lock. On top of that, you have another 9 guys from California. So right there, you got 30 guys just from Cali and Colorado. So we're not even in the Midwest. That's all mountain time zone area. If I'm mistaken, in Western time zone. So yeah, if Utah can kind of replicate that and being blessed as the furthest west team, as Chris, as you noted earlier, in men's Division I lacrosse, helps to a landing pad for guys on the West Coast, or as Tierney has done, Canadian players. Not that many this year. I know with Corona, maybe that's resulted in some players. I saw a couple guys there from Ontario on Denver's roster. But if Utah can get that pipeline back up and running too, and then get some of the, some of those Canadians players in Texas, as you guys both noticed, just starting to brim with talent. So the talent's out there, and a lot of it's the west of the Mississippi. So Utah and any other schools making the leap after the Utes can reap those benefits.
Yeah, you get parents to be able to go to games, family members, attend games. It's manageable distance to drive. It's all sorts of these things. Like there's so many benefits, but that that is kind of the occasional, how's it easy for you, inherently easier for these top schools? Because it's what's the worst case scenario for Maryland, that a kid from Florida has to drive? It's very easy to get kids, obviously, because your name, then it's easy to keep them, because they're also, even when they're not in-state, they're also close. And so that's why, if Utah can find those, in the way Denver did, to basically create your own kind of footprint. And obviously, you're fighting with Denver in that territory, but it's better to just fight with Denver than fight with, Duke and Carolina and Virginia and Maryland and Hopkins and on and on and on.
Quickly, before we go to the next game, give me a player of the game from each team. So one from Utah and one from Denver.
Denver. Go ahead,
Seth. No, you go first, because I'm potentially stealing something you already mentioned, so I don't want to steal it. So.
Denver, Jack Hanna. And I'll say Denver, Danny Logan. Rather. And then Utah, I will go with Zach Johns.
Definitely. I got Johns as well for Utah. Really, standout effort. I'm going to go a little bit of slow. I mean, not slow. He scored in the first quarter, but I'm going to go with Ethan Walker. Looked like Jack Hanna was going to have a big day, but at the end, Ethan finishes with a hat trick and an assist, if I'm not mistaken, in the fourth. So 4 points really helped to push Denver in the second half when they mounted their comeback. So I'm going to go with Walker.
I'm going to go for Utah. I'm going to go Cam Bear. He showed again that he'll be one of the top LSMs in the country, top 5, top 10. He had a really good game, and John's another great selection. I also thought Cole Brams had a really good game too from the faceoff X, 12-20. For Denver, I'd go Walker as well. Hat trick and assist. He kind of turned it on. He kind of got more aggressive late in that second half. I would like to see more of that as Denver goes to North Carolina, the state, to play Duke and North Carolina next weekend. Utah will play Bellarmine next weekend to start week 0B. I don't know. This is going to be
zero.
Weird. We're going to have like 3 week zeros, I think, in the start of the season. But
it's like the table of contents where everything's in Roman numerals.
Yeah.
the page numbers. So.
I like that. I like that. That's a good point. So we'll move on to the second game. And I have some complaints to start off with the second game. Bellarmine 9, Mercer 7. If you're Mercer, and I get it, you had a women's basketball game, you needed to stream that game at 2 o'clock. But if And they have known this probably for a while when they scheduled a game for January 30th with a start time of 11 a.m. If you knew you were going to be the first game of a sport season starting up, what in God's name are you doing not streaming the game? Maybe it's resources, maybe it's something else, whatever, but at least if you know you're going to be leading off and kicking off the start of the season, when you know people are going to be watching after 10 months of no games on the college side, and you don't have a streaming platform or a crew to stream it, all you need is a freaking camera, like, and someone to run graphics, and that's it. I'm not looking for a high-tech 120 camera game, a production of a game. I just need one camera, I just need to stream. But we don't get any. Shout out to Bellarmine's Cameron Herbert. Thank you for your servers for streaming the game on Twitter. And I think there was Cole Leggett, I believe, or someone on Mercer who was injured, who was kind of doing updates from Airside Lacrosse. But at least stream the game. Come on, Mercer. What are we doing? Anywho, 9-7 final. Bellarmine wins their first game of the season. Mercer does not. No Sean Goldsmith. We love you, buddy. He's apparently injured. I heard it'll be for a good amount of time. But, fellas, any thoughts on this game to start?
I didn't watch it. So. Mm. It's what I started doing last year, where it was like, I'm not going to, like, pretend that, like, I have anything to say when I didn't watch the game.
That's a fair point.
I miss Sean Goldsmith. That's my take.
That is a fair point. Safe, did you watch the game?
Two things. I'll have general thoughts, but like all of you, I mean, I saw a little bit of the streams over on Twitter, so shout out to those guys for, you know, stepping up. I think if Sean wasn't hurt, then we probably would have had a stream. You know what I'm saying? Because like part of me was really giving Mercer the benefit of the doubt, especially when we got like really close to game time. I was like, all right, somebody's going to be a hero. They're going to, you know, hit send on that tweet and they're like, here's the stream link. But when it didn't happen, I was like, thinking in my head, I was like, what? All right, maybe COVID, some restriction, like you couldn't have a cameraman and an announcer, but Denver was able to do that. So I think if Goldsmith wasn't hurt, like we probably would have gotten a stream, but yeah, that's just my own speculation. But otherwise on the game, you know, it's hard to really have a strong take given the fact that we didn't watch it. But, you know, just from what we've seen on the live stats, big second half effort from Bellarmine coming through with 7 goals after getting shut out in the second quarter and only posting 2 goals in first. Wish we could see it. So have more, you know, knowledgeable things to say, but, you know, at least, you know, it's not a season long injury. I mean, do you know more about the Goldsmith thing, Chris, or I don't want to speculate on that.
Not really. The only thing I got from a source close to the situation was he's hurt. He's out for about a month, I would say. Obviously, things can change with what's happened with COVID and whatever, but or if he heals quickly, but it's about a month. I'm not sure how he injured himself, but he is hurt. That's all I can say. And Mercer kind of really missed him. Their attack... really, Colin Stewart was their top scorer, 2 goals, 2 assists. There were 3 other guys that scored, and one of them was your faceoff guy in Ashton Wood, who scored 7 seconds right away off the opening draw to give Mercer a 1-0 lead. But they did really miss Sean Goldsmith on that side. I would say this, Ashton Wood looked great, and I get it. Bellarmine did not have JT Simonton. He was out due to COVID protocols, and Wood went 18 of 19. Near perfection to start your first game of the season. And this is also on the standing neutral grip face-off format, which we might get to in a little bit. I'd say this, shout out to Garrett LeClaire, 5 cost turnovers as well. Probably a short stick defensive midfielder. I'm not sure because I could barely tell who the players were from the Periscope stream I was watching, mainly because they look like ants and it's not the best quality. So I don't blame our guy Cameron for having a shoddy stream, but you get what you get and you have to take it. Eric Rubeck, a defenseman from Bellarmine, I would say he was the top player in this game. 2 goals, 2 assists, and two goals and 3 cost turnovers. And I would say this, the Eric Rubak Tuorotan campaign is officially on. In Bellarmine. Maybe the best Bellarmine players topping one and only Dylan Ward, who has had a very fine career professionally. For Mercer, I would probably go with Colin Stewart with 2-2. Actually, no, I lied. Ashton Wood. I mean, you miss one faceoff and you score a goal right away. I think that's a very dominant performance for him. So, as the only one that's watched that game, Mercer has Lenore Ryan at home next week. Bellarmine, as you mentioned, will be playing Utah to try and go 2-0 and maybe sneak into potential rankings. We'll see about that. We highly doubt it, but we'll see about that. So those are the two games that happen. There will be more next week. Friday will be Denver Duke, and then there'll be a handful more on Saturday. There will be, as we mentioned, Utah Bellarmine, Lenore Ryan, Mercer. Oh, wow, that's actually it. All right. Robert Morris Duke on Sunday, along with Denver, North Carolina, as we know of right now. So there might be more that pop up. I do want to get a couple storylines. Jake?
Was this a conference game?
This was not a conference game. This was just a...
They played a non-con conference game.
Correct. There, you'll see. I know the MAC is doing it. They'll be playing like one team, and then as like a preliminary tune-up game, and then after that, it's all conference from there. But I think it's just for scheduling purposes. Like
why not just make it a conference game?
Good point. I agree with that, but I know the SoCon's still doing one team. Their normal conference schedule, so I guess it's just for scheduling purposes, but.
I feel like if you have to schedule a conference opponent for scheduling purposes, you probably shouldn't be doing your normal conference schedule.
Fair point.
Non-normal circumstances going on here that should make you adjust. But I just realized this, like, in the middle of we're doing this.
They will play, if we all care. Mercer, the season. Bellarmine will be playing May 1st at Bellarmine. So we will literally see the transformation of two teams right in front of our eyes from January 30th to May 1st. That'll be interesting.
Do you know when the injury happened?
Wow, you are so big on this injury. I don't know when this injury happened.
It's serious news.
It's true. I just don't know a lot of details, but he's hurt.
The reason I ask is if it's been, you know, a 3 or 4 week injury. Like, shout out to Chad Sermon for first head coaching job and keeping that under the lid for multiple weeks. But if it was just something that just happened this week.
It's lacrosse. Like, it's probably the easiest sport in the world to keep, like.
Exactly. It is a tale as told as a tale as old as time. That whole late preseason injury news dump.
Entire season, and we didn't find out he was hurt till literally like 30 minutes before their first game.
Yeah.
It was
Adam Solomon. Adam Solomon Reedy. We were like driving up the game, and there's like he will not be playing.
And then they didn't tell us he was out for the year until like it just kept getting later and later in the year. And it's like, you know,
April 30th. You're not playing in the Big Ten tournament either.
Well, that's a great segue, guys, and this is why we do this podcast for segues and transitions, because we also didn't know about a kind of going back to the Denver game. There were 12 guys that missed, and we kind of touched on this a little bit too, but we'll touch on this a lot more now. 12 guys did not dress for Denver. They were unavailable due to what I was told by illness or injuries per Denver spokesman. So, and that included obviously Skylar Blair and Colin Squires and Alex Simmons. So, and this only happened because I reached out and heard a tip. Reached out to Denver. They gave me following instructions of, here's what we know. Do not release this until starting lineups are released. Okay. So if look, if this is good, we're gonna see this a lot. Whether it is, and I don't know how many teams are gonna be unveiling. You know, we might just learn about where is this guy and where is this guy, and it's actually, they are unavailable due to multiple reasons, and probably won't be. You know, we won't be able to say if it's COVID protocols or they're hurt or whatever. It's very easy in this sport to just say
just
nothing.
Say it's contact tracing. Like, you're telling me you had 12 dudes out, all due to completely different reasons?
I don't know, Jim.
Like 12 dudes all out for just... Yeah, all players not dressed due to injury or illness have been listed as on a, like, unavailable? Like, just... I don't know, man. You're just having a hard time convincing me this is not contact tracing, which is fine. Like, if that's the reason, okay, this is going to happen. Like, that's... We all are kind of aware of what's, you know, the deal here and how the season's going to go. And if you had to miss 12 dudes to the contract, okay. No, if you all tested negative, but if the rest of the team tested negative, probably it should be twice, then okay. Then go ahead and play. But, yeah, I don't know why you got to pull the whole cloak in, you know, smoke and mirrors thing of like, they're unavailable or not telling us what's going on. I don't know. You use 12 players and it's all due to extenuating circumstances. I'd like to know the last time that happened in week one of the season.
There's going to be more teams that have to kind of, even if there's a cancellation of a game, you're going to have to say why. And if it is contact tracing, then just say it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's not the end of the world. Like, we all know what the deal is here. I mean, this is not going to be a smooth... Like, if you're a fan going into this thinking we're going to get off without a hitch and there's not going to be games canceled, you're, like, being silly. Like, it's going to happen. Ideally, it's, you know, not still happening in March or April. Maybe it'll happen in March, but, you know, April or May and whatever. I don't think it will. But... And ideally, it doesn't, you know, keep some team out for, like, what, you know, like, a month or something, you know, crazy. Like, somebody saw happen in football where teams were going 3 to 4 weeks. Hopefully it's not that. But, yeah, like, there's gonna be teams that have games canceled and they have to adjust, and that's just how it's going to go. But, I don't know, saying 12 players are just unavailable. Yeah, but I don't know. It's just fine to be transparent. Like, everyone, we've all seen this now. Like, we've been doing college sports for 5 months.
Yeah, I would say this sport, especially this sport, is probably the easiest. I'd say maybe easier than football to have some contact tracing and maybe a couple of positive tests and still be able to play the game. Football, obviously, you have big roster sizes, a lot of 90 to maybe 100 guys, but you have to meet the minimum scholarship threshold. And obviously, if you have linemen that are out, then it's going to be tough to play, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's easier. Obviously, you have less positions in lacrosse than you do in football, and you don't have the whole scholarship limit to play. But that being said, we also saw Weber. Actually, today, there was supposed to be a Jacksonville scrimmage with Weber International of NAIA, and a day or two ago, it might have been Friday, that scrimmage was called off because of COVID in Weber International's program. So, and it makes sense because it's a scrimmage and you don't risk anything, especially in a scrimmage against a non-Division I team. Excuse me. But, you know, when do we see... We were talking about this in the group chat. What do we think is going to be the minimum threshold total for a team, or what's going to be the threshold for teams to say we can't play because we don't have enough guys to play? 25 guys?
I think I'd go 25. Yeah, I think if you got 6 offensive guys, you've got 2 defensive midfielders, you've got 3 defensive guys and a goalie, that's 12 guys. And then I think you need backups to some degree to those 12 guys. So I think you got 25, and I think you need a goalie. If you don't have a face-off guy, okay. Like, it sucks for you, but stick a midi or a long pull out there and do it. Like, that's it's going to happen. Hopefully not, but probably. I think if you don't have a goalie, though, that's a more of a safety issue. Like, fundamentally, to have someone who's not, you know, capable of doing that, having a projectile fly at their face the entire game. Yeah, I think if you have a goalie and you have 25, 30 guys, I think you can. I'm cool with you playing in that scenario. If you have 25 guys who have all tested like negative, if Denver had 12 dudes who had tested positive today out, I'd be like, no, that's too many guys to like go ahead and play. If you've got guys out because of like contact tracing and you're not certain and your guys test negative, then yeah, I think you can go ahead and play with 25 guys. But if I'm more apprehensive of like, well, we had these guys test positive, but these guys test negative. It's like, you need more time to then go test again to determine that. So like if it's just contact tracing, then I would say, yeah, I think 25 guys is about the number.
I think that's right. I mean, like for minimum, but again, like that's kind of, you know what I'm saying? Like that's perfect world scenario. The team had some stomach virus, you know what I mean, that took out 2 dozen guys or something like that. But yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like as risk averse as these universities are, if there is something that, you know, I could see like shutdowns coming happen. Like you're right, Jake. If it was positive cases and stuff like that, I don't think even you would need more than a handful before they would like shut it down. But yeah, around 25-30, I think it's like the bare minimum you're gonna have like a, you know, an actual enough players for to, you know, feasibly have a game against another Division I opponent.
I think weather. Weather conditions plays a part too. If you've got like, I don't think we're in this scenario in May. I certainly hope not. But if you're in May and you've got 25 guys, and it's, you know, we're talking like 90 degrees, 95, you know, and how hot it can get in some of these playoff games. Again, I don't think that's we're gonna be in that situation. I think this is a February, March kind of deal. But if in that situation, I don't know, man. That's not a lot of guys in, you know, pretty, you know, difficult, you know, conditions for athletes to play in. That might make me feel a little different if you're playing, you know, guys like the entire game in those kind of conditions. That might make me feel more apprehensive, but that's a different deal, I guess, than just strictly talking, you know, COVID.
It will be certainly interesting to figure out what happens. And obviously with more teams playing and more games playing, we're going to see a lot of different results. And obviously, I think maybe the biggest question is going to be, you know, are there any more players, quote unquote, unavailable for Denver as we enter probably one of their biggest marquee, the first marquee matchup of the season when they go to Duke and then go to North Carolina. Does maybe one game get canceled? Does maybe another? Or they just cancel the entire road trip? We'll see. I believe that's all in terms of game action and kind of storylines we have. There are some questions that our Twitterers or users and followers have sent over. We'll start with Corey Bulkin. Please discuss Denver using their small army to stand in for the fans. And if you didn't see their picture, National Anthem, they had most of their players in the stands for the National Anthem. I thought that was going to be their bench, but I guess that never happened. But that seemed like a very interesting thing. Might have been protocol.
That's what I was thinking. I was like, they just didn't want to be first team on camera and all of them were in a line, like 2 inches apart. So, and that was kind of cool. I won't lie. I thought it was kind of cool. I thought there were fans in the stands, you know, for a second. But, That's immediately the first thing, but maybe that's just like our brains are conditioned that, you know, first thing is anything that happens, you know, it's like, oh, it's COVID related, you know? So
I liked it. Paul Schaefer or Schaffer said, your take on SNG faceoffs, SNG standard neutral grip faceoffs in the first few games. Any difference in terms of less lockup? Sounds like it could be easier to cheat if refs are not on top of it. It seemed quicker. There weren't a lot of tie-ups, and if there were, they was kind of very short. You know, we'll see. You know, Stathakis, who had one of the better years last year, he obviously struggled. Cole Brams went 12-20. I don't know if it's maybe because Brams is overall better, and if we had the, you know, the same, the old format, motorcycle grip on one knee, if we would have seen a change. But, you know, I'm excited for it. I was happy. I didn't really pay attention to it. I might have seen, like, three or four face-offs, if I'm being quite honest, but it seems good.
I couldn't. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe if you guys, I couldn't recall one prolonged, like one of those like 30-second, 45-second like scrums. Like I can't remember there being like one of those. And that I think was the whole point of the deal, was that, and maybe trying to, you know, level the playing field in terms of the effectiveness of the, or the impact of the game, rather, that the face-off guy has, to which, like I said, just make a position player do it. But, yeah, I can't recall, and I think also part of it, I think, was injuries, too. These face-off guys are just, like, killing themselves. And so, yeah, I couldn't recall there being, like, one of those, you know, like, where it goes for 30 or 45 seconds, like, there was one in the playoffs, I think, when Penn State played Yale with Arcari and TD, which went for, like, over a minute, and it's like, that's just ridiculous. So, no, I don't think there was one of those. And if there wasn't, then that was the goal, and good. Because, frankly, I didn't find that to be entertaining in any sort of way.
By the way, just to note, the team that won the face-off battle overall today lost the game. Says a lot about face-offs. Mike Tobin asked, your take on Denver's starting lineup today, including seven midfielders as opposed to three. So what he's mentioning is their Twitter graphic put not only the normal offensive midfielders, but also the face-off guy and the defensive midfielders. Personally, you know, I love it because, look, they're kind of starting mid. They are starting, technically, because they're coming on the field. And if we're considering midfielders, the starting midfielders, the three offensive guys that come on the field after starting the game on the sideline, you might as well do the same thing for your defensive midfielders, too, because they are technically midfielders. I like this. I think more teams should do that, at least when you discuss a starting lineup. I think we have to at least, I'm speaking on the TV end, because I've also been trying to push at least presenting starting lineups on the television broadcast, and my hope is to at least branch out to do the starting defensive midfield, because they are also as important and would be helpful for newer fans to say, hey, this is a defensive midfielders, not the, you know, as we call them, the starting midfielders or the offensive midfielders. I don't think anyone else cares as much as I do, but I like that idea.
I think if there's one thing I'd like to see you push, Chris, I need, like, and it's more also like a Twitter thing and not just the TV thing. I need like actual like graphics for the starting lineups.
That's what I was also pushing. Like
your three defensemen, I want to see like your three attack. Like, you know, soccer does it. You know, like the formation. And I know lacrosse doesn't have like formations in that same way. But like, I want to see like that.
Even if it's like a scorebook pop, like you just see, like, I know we have them for like a scene setter, like, hey, this is where we're at, these teams, color of the jerseys and the broadcasters. If you even just
some teams just like they just list the players
exactly,
and I'm like, what position does he play? Like, what, you know? And it's just, or like, are they listed in like numerical order? And I'm like, so is that guy a defender? Is he? Is that what you're doing? And it's like, gave me like a. At minimum, give me, you know, position titles. But yeah, I'd like to see, like, some teams do it. I've seen one or two teams do it in the last couple of years.
Maryland, yeah. I think Maryland's one of those teams that does it, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't think so. I think Maryland does.
I think it's a graphic when the guy scores. This is a nice little thing.
That's good. Yeah, I like that. That they just close up. I mean, look, it's all improved. I remember tweeting Maryland like 7 years ago, like, hey guys, can you post the starting lineup? And they just didn't. Which, by the way, this was shocking. Like, Bellarmine literally didn't tweet during the game.
Yeah.
Not only did they not tweet, they literally didn't tell. They didn't tell anybody the game was happening. Like, I don't think they had a tweet today.
Like, I think they retweeted a couple of Bellarmine accounts. If I'm not mistaken, let me go on their. Let's go on their account. Let's do some snooping.
It was kind of wild. Like, they weren't like. They weren't like tweeting, or like even just, you know, to like to start the game. Like, here, man, like the game is starting now. Like, you know, like, or like Mercer did, you know, where it's like start time, stadium, live stats, whatever deal, you know, even something like that. There's like,
so
Navy also is like radio silent during games, which, like, being that in 2021, like, blows my mind.
It's the military training.
So Bellarmine, Jake, coming off of your point, before the game, which was, I think, the day before the game, they tweeted about a U.S. Lacrosse magazine preview of Bellarmine Mercer. Then they retweeted, after the game was over, Inside Lacrosse's tweeted of a final and their game story. And then they tweeted their mascot's tweet about the team winning a game. And then they retweeted Bellarmine Athletics' tweet about, hey, their official recap, written recap, and then they went on with a, you know, re-agree, shout out Dylan Ward, and more recaps and whatever. So
their last Bellarmine Lacrosse tweet is January 18th. I'm mic'd up with John Lignard.
That's wild.
Wow.
So to find
everything else is as retweets.
I went and looked and found, so Maryland's, for example, because I scrolled through their page, they do it in, like, order, but you'd have to, like, know the players. So, like, they go from, like, goalie, and so, like, this was for the last game of the season. McNaney, Grill, Maycard, Rahill, Brennan, DeMayo, Fairman, Maltz, Wisnowskis, Bernhardt. If you know the team, you know that's going in order from goalie to defense to midfield to attack. But you'd have to know, like, that's who the players are. Like, if you didn't know, you know, if you were just, like, new to lacrosse, or you were, you know, hadn't watched Maryland, which, I mean, you know, if you watch lacrosse, obviously will, but you get my point. Like, you wouldn't really, you wouldn't be aware. So, like, at least I think, like, you know, and look, Maryland's, they're very good, like, with social media and stuff. But I still think, like, at least telling us that it's, like, attack or midfield or starting or short stick midi or long stick midi, the whole thing. I think that would be a improvement. And then, yeah, if you want to do, like, a full-on graphic with, like, here's the three defensemen, then show me, you know, like, your face-off guy and then the two wings, and that's, like, soccer does it, that would be, that'd really be going above and beyond, but it'd be cool.
John Erickson had a quartet of questions. I think we really answered all of them. Why was Denver's man up terrible? We kind of got with that rust. Who will play on the Denver top six when everyone is back? We kind of talked about that. How good is Utah? We talked about that. What do you think of the faceoffs with all the leaning? We just talked about that. So, good questions, John. We already answered them. Shout out to you. Chad Martin. Young Utes or rusty piles and goalies? Well, we already talked about both, so thank you, Chad. Also, play of the game. I also kind of talked about that, so there you go. Unless anyone else had a different answer for that, but I guess that didn't really matter. Brian Horton, our good friend, how being near perfect at the faceoff meant very little in today's SoCon game rarely seen. Kind of just talked about that too. You know, it says a lot about the faceoff position. It's just a position, and I get it. Like, oh, TD, remember when we were all talking about how TD Erland was so dominant and safe wanted to eliminate the faceoff completely, and, well, some guy just went nearly 100% for the faceoff X, and his team lost. So it's just once, a position.
Once, not wanted. So. It's an active and ongoing campaign.
I need to see more, but I mean, yeah, like, I've been saying this for, like, I've said this for a while, you know, like, when teams are like, the faceoff is the most important position in lacrosse, it's like, you know, how do you stop a guy who goes 24 whatever on faceoff? Like, you just play good defense. Just get stops. Like,
exactly.
Chris, you remember this. I know what Syracuse, like, just never couldn't win a faceoff to save their lives before they got Ben Williams.
Yep.
And like, Desko was like, ban the faceoff, which was hilarious. But Syracuse fans are just, like, obsessing over the faceoff because Brandon Fowler stomped on him in the one championship game, and then they were bad the year after. I remember Charlie Raffa stomped on him. And it was, like, existential crisis. I was like, you know what the real issue was for Syracuse during that time? It's that their defense was bad. Like, they were, like, bad in terms of, like, defensive efficiency and stuff, too. They weren't getting the real issue, and, like, why they eventually, even though they were bad on faceoffs both years, still wound up getting to the championship game in 2013, and then they were top two seed in 2014, was because their defense got better, and they could, even despite being bad on faceoffs, could still, you know, get through to the championship. Like Maryland in 2017. Remember when they faced, like, just all three top faceoff guys in the country and won all three of those games? It's because they had the best defense. So, like, it's the faceoff is obviously important. It's not that it's not. But it's there was this, like, there's been this thing where it's like this bulletproof, you know, solves everything. And, like, didn't TD dominate Virginia in the game in 2019? And Virginia won by what, like, 5 goals? So, like, I would be interested to see, like, if, you know, we get more of these games, maybe, or if, you know,
Mercer was throwing the ball all over the place.
Yeah, like, well, and also
31 turnovers.
Oh, a slop fest. Lovely, a slop fest.
You kind of squander that whole, you know, they won essentially 15 straight face-off, but they also had 22 in the first three quarters, but they also had 22 turnovers in those first three quarters. Yeah, you kind of just, like, throwing away.
Well, and the thing is that, like, I don't think it says anything to do with the new face-off necessarily, because, like, whether the change in the face-off or not, the game itself is still relatively, you know, the same. So I don't know if it says anything about that. I think it'll just be interesting to see if we see more, whether or not we see more of these kind, like, do we see more, you know, 20 of 20 games? You know, like, is that, does the, I guess there's two ways of it going. You could say that there's some guys, if, like, some guys, two or three guys, just get it down pat, like, they just figure it out really well, then maybe you could get, like, two or three or four guys who get to, like, 70-75% the way we saw. Or does, like, no one really perfect it, and then it kind of comes back to, like, what I think they want, which is maybe the best face-off guy in the country is, like, 67-68%. Because that, I think, was the real thing, was, like, it was fine when the best face-off guy won 60%, and then it was a little less fine, but still fine when he won 65%. It got a bit different when the best guys were winning, like, 75%. And it was, like, you know, you'd have, like, TD and Trevor would go, like, three or four games a year where they just won every face-off. That's when I think it became a bit different. But yeah, it's like, look, man, like, it's winning face-offs are great, and it'll continue to help teams with the new way of doing it, and just as it did with the old way. But it's not as if, you know, like, how many times has it's pretty darn simple. How many times has the team with the best face-off percentage in college lacrosse won the national championship? I don't know for sure, but I don't think it's all that often.
That should do it for our first episode of the R&R podcast. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at Chris_Jast. Jake, yours is?
At Jake_Nazar. Just hit the follow request. I'm locked. I'll be locked for like 5 more months. After that, I'll be posting horrible tweets and flagrant tweets for all of you to enjoy once again.
I am at Erie_Barrister.
And you can obviously follow College Cross at College_Cross. And on Instagram, we are making that active again. And there are now memes on the account. So if you like memes, which you all do, hit the follow button. We will see you later this week for some more stuff.
Thank you, Lynch, for president. And stay hydrated.